Riley was at the far end of the ship, walking the poop deck, but there were many sailors in earshot, getting the launch and the officer's barge over the side, preparing to begin the process of supply, and Lord Purbeck was overseeing. In any case, one could not say anything on deck in full voice, and not expect it to have travelled to the other end and back in less time than it would take to walk the distance. Lawrence was conscious of the plain rudeness of seeming to criticise Riley on the deck of his own ship, even without the quarrel already lingering between them. But at last he could not forbear.
"Pray, do not be distressed," he said,
trying to console Temeraire without going so far as to speak too bluntly against the practice.
"There is reason to hope that the trade will soon be stopped. The question will come before Parliament again this very session."
Temeraire brightened perceptibly at the news, but he was unsatisfied with so bare an explanation, and proceeded to inquire with great energy into the prospects of abolition. Lawrence perforce had to explain Parliament, and the distinction between the Commons and the Lords, and the various factions engaged in the debate, relying for his particulars on his father's activities, but aware all the while that he was overheard and trying as best he could to be politic. Even Sun Kai, who had been on deck the whole morning, and seen the progress of the snow and its effects on Temeraire's mood, gazed upon him thoughtfully, evidently guessing at some of the conversation. He had come as near as he could without crossing the painted border, and during a break he asked Temeraire to translate for him. Temeraire explained a little. Sun Kai nodded, and then inquired of Lawrence,
"Your father is an official, then, and feels this practice dishonourable?"
Such a question, put baldly, could not be evaded, however much it might offend. Silence would be very nearly dishonest.
"Yes, sir, he does,"
Lawrence said. And before Sun Kai could prolong the conversation with further inquiries, Keynes came up to the deck. Lawrence hailed him to ask him for permission to take Temeraire on a short flight to shore, and so was able to cut short the discussion. Even so abbreviated, however, it did no good for relations aboard ship. The sailors, mostly without strong opinions on the subject, naturally took their own captain's part, and felt Riley ill-used by the open expression of such sentiments on his ship when his own family connections to the trade were known. The post was rowed back shortly before the hands' dinner-time, and Lord Purbeck chose to send the young midshipman Reynolds, who had set off the recent quarrel, to bring over the letters for the aviators. Nearly a piece of deliberate provocation. The boy himself, his eye still blacked from Blythe's powerful blow, smirked so insolently that Lawrence instantly resolved on ending Martin's punishment duty nearly a week before he had otherwise intended, and said quite deliberately,
"Temeraire, look, we have a letter from Captain Rowland. It will have news of Dover, I am sure."
Temeraire obligingly put his head down to inspect the letter. The ominous shadow of the ruff and the serrated teeth gleaming so nearby made a profound impression on Reynolds. The smirk vanished, and almost as quickly so did he himself, hastily retreating from the Dragon deck. Lawrence stayed on deck to read the letters with Temeraire. Jane Rowland's letter, scarcely a page long, had been sent only a few days after their departure, and had very little news, only a cheerful account of the life of the covert, heartening to read, even if it left Temeraire sighing a little for home, and Lawrence with much the same sentiments. He was a little puzzled, however, at receiving no other letters from his colleagues. Since a courier had come through, he had expected to have something from Harcourt, at least, whom he knew to be a good correspondent, and perhaps one of the other captains. He did have one more letter from his mother, which had been forwarded on from Dover. Aviators received their mail quicker than anyone else, post-dragons making their rounds from covert to covert, whence the mail went out by horse and rider, and she had evidently written and sent it before receiving Lawrence's own letter informing her of their departure. He opened it and read most of it aloud for Temeraire's entertainment. She wrote mainly of his oldest brother George, who had just added a daughter to his three sons, and his father's political work, as being one of the few subjects on which Lawrence and Lord Allendale were in sympathy, and which now was of fresh interest to Temeraire as well. Midway, however, Lawrence abruptly stopped, as he read to himself a few lines which she had made in passing, which explained the unexpected silence of his fellow officers.
"Naturally, we were all very much shocked by the dreadful news of the disaster in Austria, and they say that Mr. Pitt has taken ill, which of course much grieves your father, as the Prime Minister has always been a friend to the cause. I am afraid I hear much talk in town of how Providence is favouring Bonaparte. It does seem strange that one man should make so great a difference in the course of war, when on both sides numbers are equal. But it is shameful in the extreme how quickly Lord Nelson's great victory at Trafalgar is forgot, and your own noble defence of our shores, and men of less resolution begin to speak of peace with the tyrant.
She had, of course, written expecting him to be still at Dover, where news from the Continent came first, and where he would have long since heard all there was to know. Instead, it came as a highly unpleasant shock, particularly as she gave no further particulars. He had heard reports in Madeira of several battles fought in Austria, but nothing so decisive. At once he begged Temeraire to forgive him, and hastened below to Riley's cabin, hoping there might be more news, and indeed found Riley numbly reading an express dispatch which Hammond had just given him, received from the ministry.
"You smashed them all to pieces, outside Austerlitz," Hammond said,
and they searched out the place on Riley's maps, a small town deep in Austria, northeast of Vienna.
"I have not been told a great deal. Government is reserving the particulars, but he has taken at least 30,000 men dead, wounded or prisoner. The Russians are fleeing, and the Austrians have signed an armistice already."
These spare facts were grim enough without elaboration, and they all fell silent together, looking over the few lines of the message which disobligingly refused to offer more information, regardless of the number of times they were re-read.
"Well," Hammond said finally, "we will just have to starve him out. Thank God for Nelson and Trafalgar. And he cannot mean to invade by air again, not with three long wings stationed in the channel now."
"Ought we not return?" Lawrence ventured awkwardly.
It seemed so self-serving a proposal he felt guilty in making it, and yet he could not imagine they were not badly needed back in Britain. Exidium, Mortiferous, and Lily, with their formations, were indeed a deadly force to be reckoned with, but three dragons could not be everywhere, and Napoleon had before this found means of drawing one or the other away.
"I have received no orders to turn back," Riley said, "though I will say it does feel damned peculiar to be sailing on to China, devil may care, after news like this, with a 150-gun ship and a heavy combat dragon."
"Gentlemen, you are in error," Hammond said sharply. "This disaster only renders our mission all the more urgent. If Napoleon is to be beaten, if our nation is to preserve a place as anything more besides an inconsequential island off the coast of a French Europe, only trade will do it. The Austrians may have been beaten for the moment, and the Russians, but so long as we can supply our continental allies with funds and with resources, you may be sure they will resist Bonaparte's tyranny. We must continue on. We must secure at least neutrality from China, if not some advantage, and protect our eastern trade. No military goal could be of greater significance."
He spoke with great authority, and Riley nodded in quick agreement. Lawrence was silent as they began to discuss how they might speed the journey, and shortly he excused himself to return to the dragon deck. He could not argue. He was not impartial by any means, and Hammond's arguments had a great deal of weight. But he was not satisfied, and he felt an uneasy distress at the lack of sympathy between their thinking and his own.
"I cannot understand how they let Napoleon beat them," Temeraire said, rough, bristling, when Lawrence had broken the unhappy news to him and his senior officers. "He had more ships and dragons than we did at Trafalgar and at Dover, and we still won, and this time the Austrians and the Russians outnumbered him."
"Trafalgar was a sea battle," Lawrence said. "Bonaparte has never really understood the navy. He is an artilleryman himself by training, and the Battle of Dover we won only thanks to you, otherwise I dare say Bonaparte would be having himself crowned in Westminster directly. Do not forget how he managed to trick us into sending the better part of the Channel forces south, and concealed the movements of his own dragons before the invasion. If he had not been taken by surprise by the divine wind, the outcome could have been quite different."
"It still does not seem to me that the battle was cleverly managed," Temeraire said, dissatisfied. "I am sure if we had been there with our friends, we should not have lost, and I do not see why we are going to China when other people are fighting."
"I call that a damn good question," Granby said. "A great pack of nonsense to begin with, giving away one of our very best dragons in the middle of a war, when we are so desperate hard up to begin with. Lawrence, oughtn't we go home?"
Lawrence only shook his head. He was too much in agreement and too powerless to make any alteration. Temeraire and the Divine Wind had changed the course of the war at Dover. As little as the ministry might like to admit it or give credit for a victory to so narrow a cause, Lawrence too well remembered the hopeless, uneven struggle of that day before Temeraire had turned the tide. To be meekly surrendering Temeraire and his extraordinary abilities seemed to Lawrence a wilful blindness, and he did not believe the Chinese would yield to any of Hammond's requests at all. "But we have our orders," was all he said. Even if Riley and Hammond had been of like mind with him, Lawrence knew very well this would scarcely be accepted by the ministry as even a thin excuse for violating their standing orders.
"I am sorry," he added, seeing that Temeraire was inclined to be unhappy. "But come, here is Mr. Keynes, to see if you can be allowed to take some exercise on shore. Let us clear away and let him make his examination."
"Truly, it does not pain me at all," Temeraire said anxiously, peering down at himself as Keynes at last stepped back from his chest. "I am sure I am ready to fly again, and I will only go a short way."
Keynes shook his head.
"Another week, perhaps. No, do not set up a howl at me," he said sternly as Temeraire sat up to protest. "It is not a question of the length of the flight. Launching is the difficulty," he added to Lawrence by way of grudging explanation. "The strain of getting aloft will be the most dangerous moment, and I am not confident the muscles are yet prepared to bear it." "But I am so very tired of only lying on deck," Temeraire said disconsolately, almost a wail. "I cannot even turn around properly."
"It will only be another week, and perhaps less," Lawrence said, trying to comfort him.
He was already regretting that he had ever made the proposal and raised Temeraire's hopes only to see them dashed.
"I am very sorry. But Mr. Keynes's opinion is worth more than either of ours on the subject, and we had better listen to him."
Temeraire was not so easily appeased.
"I do not see why his opinion should be worth more than mine. It is my muscle, after all."
Keynes folded his arms and said coolly,
"I am not going to argue with a patient. If you want to do yourself an injury and spend another 2 months lying about instead, by all means go jumping about as much as you like."
Temeraire snorted back at this reply, and Lawrence, annoyed, hurried to dismiss Keynes before the surgeon could be any more provoking. He had every confidence in the man's skill, but his tact could have stood much improvement, and though Temeraire was by no means contrary by nature, this was a hard disappointment to bear.
"I have a little better news, at least," he told Temeraire, trying to rally his spirits. "Mr. Pollitt was kind enough to bring me several new books from his visit ashore. Shall I not fetch one now?"
Temeraire made only a grumble for answer, head unhappily drooping over the edge of the ship and gazing towards the denied shore. Lawrence went down for the book, hoping that the interest of the material would rouse him, but while he was still in his cabin, the ship abruptly rocked, and an enormous splash outside sent water flying in through the opened round windows and onto the floor. Lawrence ran to look through the nearest porthole, hastily rescuing his dampened letters, and saw Temeraire, with an expression at once guilty and self-satisfied, bobbing up and down in the water. He dashed back up to the deck. Granby and Ferris were peering over the side in alarm, and the small boats that had been crowding around the sides of the ship, full of whores and enterprising fishermen, were already making frantic haste away and back to the security of the harbour, with much shrieking and splashing of oars. Temeraire rather abashedly looked after them in dismay.
"I did not mean to frighten them," he said. "There is no need to run away," he called.
But the boats did not pause for an instant. The sailors, deprived of their entertainments, glared disapprovingly. Lawrence was more concerned for Temeraire's health.
"Well, I have never seen anything so ridiculous in my life, but it is not likely to hurt him. The air sacs will keep him afloat, and salt water never hurt a wound,"
Keynes said, having been summoned back to the deck.
"But how we will ever get him back aboard, I have not the least idea."
Temeraire plunged for a moment under the surface and came almost shooting up again, propelled by his buoyancy.
"It is very pleasant," he called out. "The water is not cold at all, Lawrence. Will you not come in?"
Lawrence was by no means a strong swimmer, and uneasy at the notion of leaping into the open ocean. They were a good mile out from the shore. But he took one of the ship's small boats and rowed himself out to keep Temeraire company and to be sure the Dragon did not overtire himself after so much enforced idleness on deck. The skiff was tossed about a little by the waves resulting from Temeraire's frolics, and occasionally swamped, but Lawrence had prudently worn only an old pair of breeches and his most threadbare shirt. His own spirits were very low. The defeat at Austerlitz was not merely a single battle lost, but the overthrow of Prime Minister Pitt's whole careful design, and the destruction of the coalition assembled to stop Napoleon. Britain alone could not field an army half so large as Napoleon's Grande Armée, nor easily land it on the continent, and with the Austrians and Russians now driven from the field, their situation was plainly grim. Even with such cares, however, he could not help but smile to see Temeraire so full of energy and uncomplicated joy, and after a little while he even yielded to Temeraire's coaxing and let himself over the side. Lawrence did not swim very long, but soon climbed up onto Temeraire's back, while Temeraire paddled himself about enthusiastically and nosed the skiff about as a sort of toy. He might shut his eyes and imagine them back in Dover, or at Loch Laggan, with only the ordinary cares of war to burden them, and work to be done which he understood, with all the confidence of friendship and a nation united behind them. Even the present disaster hardly insurmountable in such a situation. The Allegiance only another ship in the harbour, their familiar clearing a short flight away, and no politicians and princes to trouble with. He lay back and spread his hand open against the warm side, the black scales warmed by the sun, and for a little while indulged the fancy enough to drowse.
"Do you suppose you will be able to climb back aboard the Allegiance?" Lawrence said presently.
He had been worrying the problem in his head. Temeraire craned his head around to look at him.
"Could we not wait here on shore until I am well again, and rejoin the ship after?" he suggested. "Or,"
and his ruff quivered with sudden excitement,
"we might fly across the continent and meet them on the opposite side. There are no people in the middle of Africa, I remember from your maps, so there cannot be any French to shoot us down."
"No, but by report there are a great many feral dragons, not to mention any number of other dangerous creatures and the perils of disease," Lawrence said. "We cannot go flying over the uncharted interior, Temeraire. The risk cannot be justified, particularly not now."
Temeraire sighed a little at giving up this ambitious project, but agreed to make the attempt to climb up onto the deck. After a little more play, he swam back over to the ship, and rather bemused the waiting sailors by handing the skiff up to them so they did not have to haul her back aboard. Lawrence, having climbed up the side from Temeraire's shoulder, held a huddled conference with Riley.
"Perhaps if we let the starboard sheet anchor down as a counterweight," he suggested, "that with the best bower ought to keep her steady, and she is already loaded heavy towards the stern."
"Lawrence, what the Admiralty will say to me if I get a transport sunk on a clear blue day in harbour, I should not like to think," Riley said, unhappy at the notion. "I dare say I should be hanged, and deserve it, too."
"If there is any danger of capsizing, he can always let go in an instant," Lawrence said. "Otherwise we must sit in port a week at least, until Keynes is willing to grant him leave to fly again."
"I am not going to sink the ship,"
Temeraire said indignantly, poking his head up over the quarter-deck rail and entering into the conversation, much to Riley's startlement.
"I will be very careful."
Though Riley was still dubious, he finally gave leave. Temeraire managed to rear up out of the water and get a grip with his foreclaws on the ship's side. The Allegiance listed towards him, but not too badly, held by the two anchors, and having raised his wings out of the water, Temeraire beat them a couple of times and half leapt, half scrambled up the side of the ship. He fell heavily onto the deck without much grace, hind legs scrabbling for an undignified moment, but he indeed got aboard, and the Allegiance did not do more than bounce a little beneath him. He hastily settled his legs underneath him again and busied himself shaking water off his rough and long tendrils, pretending he had not been clumsy.
"It was not very difficult to climb back on at all," he said to Lawrence, pleased. "Now I can swim every day until I can fly again."
Lawrence wondered how Riley and the sailors would receive this news, but was unable to feel much dismay. He would have suffered far more than black looks to see Temeraire's spirits so restored, and when he presently suggested something to eat, Temeraire gladly assented, and devoured two cows and a sheep down to the hooves. When Yong Xing once again ventured to the deck the following morning, he thus found Temeraire in good humour, fresh from another swim, well-fed, and highly pleased with himself. He had clambered aboard much more gracefully this second time, though Lord Purbeck at least found something to complain of in the scratches to the ship's paint, and the sailors were still unhappy at having the bumboats frightened off. Yongxing himself benefited, as Temeraire was in a forgiving mood, and disinclined to hold even what Lawrence considered a well-deserved grudge. But the prince did not look at all satisfied. He spent the morning visit watching silently and brooding as Lawrence read to Temeraire out of the new books procured by Mr. Pollitt on his visit ashore. Yongxing soon left again, and shortly thereafter his servant, Feng Li, came up to the deck to ask Lawrence below, making clear his meaning through gestures and pantomime, Temeraire having settled down to nap through the heat of the day. Unwilling and wary, Lawrence insisted on first going to his quarters to dress. He was again in shabby clothes, having accompanied Temeraire on his swim, and did not feel prepared to face Yongxing in his austere and elegant apartment without the armour of his dress coat and best trousers, and a fresh pressed neckcloth. There was no theatre about his arrival this time. He was ushered in at once, and Yongxing sent even Feng Li away, that they might be private. But he did not speak at once, and only stood in silence, hands clasped behind his back, gazing frowningly out the stern windows. Then, as Lawrence was on the point of speaking, he abruptly turned and said,
"You have sincere affection for Lung Tian Xiang, and he for you. This I have come to see. Yet in your country he is treated like an animal, exposed to all the dangers of war. Can you desire this fate for him?"
Lawrence was much astonished at meeting so direct an appeal, and supposed Hammond proven right. There could be no explanation for this change but a growing conviction in Yongxing's mind of the futility of luring Temeraire away. But as pleased as he would otherwise have been to see Yongxing give up his attempts to divide them from one another, Lawrence grew only more uneasy. There was plainly no common ground to be had between them, and he did not feel he understood Yongxing's motives for seeking to find any.
"Sir," he said after a moment, "your accusations of ill-treatment I must dispute, and the dangers of war are the common hazard of those who take service for their country. Your Highness can scarcely expect me to find such a choice, willingly made, objectionable. I myself have so chosen, and such risks I hold it an honour to endure."
"Yet you are a man of ordinary birth, and a soldier of no great rank. There may be 10,000 men such as you in England," Yongxing said. "You cannot compare yourself to a celestial. Consider his happiness, and listen to my request. Help us restore him to his rightful place, and then part from him cheerfully. Let him think you are not sorry to go, that he may forget you more easily, and find happiness with a companion appropriate to his station. Surely it is your duty not to hold him down to your own level, but to see him brought up to all the advantages which are his right."
Yongxing made these remarks not in an insulting tone, but as stating plain fact, almost earnestly.
"I do not believe in that species of kindness, sir, which consists in lying to a loved one and deceiving him for his own good," Lawrence said, as yet unsure whether he ought to be offended or to view this as some attempt to appeal to his better nature.
But his confusion was sharply dispelled in another moment as Yongxing persisted.
"I know that what I ask is a great sacrifice. Perhaps the hopes of your family will be disappointed, and you were given a great reward for bringing him to your country, which may now be confiscated. We do not expect you to face ruin. Do as I ask, and you will receive 10,000 taels of silver, and the gratitude of the Emperor."
Lawrence stared first, then flushed to an ugly shade of mortification, and said, when he had mastered himself well enough to speak, with bitter resentment,
"A noble sum indeed. But there is not silver enough in China, sir, to buy me."
He would have turned to go at once, but Yongxing said in real exasperation, this refusal at last driving him past the careful facade of patience which he had so far maintained throughout the interview,
"You are foolish! You cannot be permitted to remain companion to Lung Tian Xiang, and in the end you will be sent home. Why not accept my offer?"
"'That you may separate us by force, in your own country, I have no doubt,' Lawrence said. "'But that will be your doing, and none of mine. "'And he shall know me faithful as he is himself, to the last.'
"'He meant to leave. "'He could not challenge Yong Xing, nor strike him, "'and only such a gesture could have begun to satisfy his deep and violent sense of injury. "'But so excellent an invitation to quarrel at least gave his anger some vent.' And he added with all the scorn which he could give the words,
"'Save yourself the trouble of any further cajolery. All your bribes and machinations, you may be sure, will meet with equal failure, and I have too much faith in Temeraire to imagine that he will ever be persuaded to prefer a nation where discourse such as this is the civilized mode.'
"'You speak in ignorant disdain of the foremost nation of the world,' Yong Xing said, growing angry himself. "'Like all your countrymen, who show no respect for that which is superior, and insult our customs.'
"'For which I might consider myself as owing you some apology, sir, if you yourself had not so often insulted myself and my own country, or shown respect for any customs other than your own,' Lawrence said.
"'We do not desire anything that is yours, or to come and force our ways upon you,' Yong Xing said. From your small island you come to our country, and out of kindness you are allowed to buy our tea and silk and porcelain, which you so passionately desire. But still you are not content. You forever demand more and more, while your missionaries try to spread your foreign religion, and your merchants smuggle opium in defiance of the law. We do not need your trinkets, your clockworks and lamps and guns. Our land is sufficient unto itself. In so unequal a position, you should show threefold gratitude and submission to the Emperor, and instead you offer one insult heaped on another. Too long already has this disrespect been tolerated.
These arrayed grievances, so far beyond the matter at hand, were spoken passionately and with great energy. More sincere than anything Lawrence had formerly heard from the prince, and more unguarded, and the surprise he could not help but display evidently recalled Yong Xing to his circumstances and checked his flow of speech. For a moment they stood in silence, Lawrence still resentful, and as unable to form a reply as if Yong Xing had spoken in his native tongue, baffled entirely by a description of the relations between their countries which should lump Christian missionaries together in with smugglers, and so absurdly refused to acknowledge the benefits of free and open trade to both parties.
"'I am no politician, sir, to dispute with you upon matters of foreign policy,' Lawrence said at last. "'But the honour and dignities of my nation and my countrymen I will defend to my last breath, and you will not move me with any argument to act dishonourably, least of all to Temeraire.'
Yong Xing had recovered his composure, yet looked still intensely dissatisfied. Now he shook his head, frowning.
"'If you will not be persuaded by consideration for Long Tien Xiang, or for yourself, will you at least serve your country's interests?'
With deep and evident reluctance he added,
"'That we should open ports to you besides Canton cannot be considered. But we will permit your ambassador to remain in Peking, as you so greatly desire, and we will not agree to go to war against you or your allies, so long as you maintain a respectful obedience to the Emperor. This much can be allowed if you will ease Long Tien Xiang's return.'
He ended expectantly. Lawrence stood motionless, breath-taken, white. And then he said,
"No,"
almost inaudibly, and without staying to hear another word, turned and left the room, thrusting the drapery from his way. He went blindly to the deck and found Temeraire sleeping, peaceful, tail curled around himself. Lawrence did not touch him, but sat down on one of the lockers by the edge of the deck and bowed his head down, that he should not meet anyone's eyes, his hands clasped, that they should not be seen to shake. "'You refused, I hope?' Hammond said, wholly unexpectedly. Lawrence, who had steeled himself to face a furious reproach, was left staring. Thank heaven! It had not occurred to me that he might attempt a direct approach, and so soon.
I must beg you, Captain, to be sure and not commit us to any proposal whatsoever without private consultation with me, no matter how appealing it may seem. Either here or after we have reached China," he added, as an afterthought. "Now, pray tell me again. He offered a promise of neutrality and a permanent envoy in Peking, outright?" There was a quick, predatory gleam in his expression, and Lawrence was put to dredging the details of the conversation from his memory, in answer to his many questions.
"But I am sure that I do not misremember. He was quite firm that no other ports should ever be opened."
Lawrence protested when Hammond had begun dragging over his maps of China, and speculating aloud which might be the most advantageous, inquiring of Lawrence which harbours he thought best for shipping.
"Yes, yes," Hammond said, waving this aside. "But if he may be brought so far as to admit the possibility of a permanent envoy, how much more progress may we not hope to make? You must be aware that his own opinions are fixed quite immovably against all intercourse with the West."
"I am," Lawrence said.
He was more surprised to find Hammond so aware, given the diplomat's continuing efforts to establish good relations.
"Our chances of winning Prince Yongxing himself over are small, though I hope we do make some progress," Hammond said. "But I find it most encouraging indeed that he should be so anxious to obtain your cooperation at such a stage. Plainly he wishes to arrive in China, fait accompli, which should only be the case if he imagines the Emperor may be persuaded to grant us terms less pleasing to himself."
"He's not the heir to the throne, you know," Hammond added, seeing Lawrence look doubtful. "The Emperor has three sons, and the eldest, Prince Mianning, is grown already, and the presumptive Crown Prince. Not that Prince Yongxing lacks in influence, certainly, or he would never have been given so much autonomy as to be sent to England, but this very attempt on his part gives me hope that there may yet be more opportunity than we heretofore have realized. If only." Here he grew abruptly dismal and sat down again with the charts neglected. "If only the French have not already established themselves with the more liberal minds of the court," he finished low. "But that would explain a great deal, I am afraid, and in particular why they were ever given the egg. I could tear my hair over it. Here they have managed to thoroughly insinuate themselves, I suppose, while we have been sitting about congratulating ourselves on our precious dignity ever since Lord Macartney was sent packing, and making no real attempt to restore relations."
Lawrence left, feeling very little less guilt and unhappiness than before. His refusal, he was well aware, had not been motivated by any such rational and admirable arguments, but a wholly reflexive denial. He would certainly never agree to lie to Temeraire, as Yongxing had proposed, nor abandon him to any unpleasant or barbaric situation. But Hammond might make other demands less easy to refuse. If they were ordered to separate to ensure a truly advantageous treaty, it would be his own duty not only to go, but to convince Temeraire to obey, however unwillingly. Before now he had consoled himself in the belief that the Chinese would offer no satisfactory terms. This illusory comfort was now stripped away, and all the misery of separation loomed closer with every sea mile. 2 days later saw them leaving Cape Coast, gladly for Lawrence's part. The morning of their departure a party of slaves had been brought in overland and were being driven into the waiting dungeons within sight of the ship. An even more dreadful scene ensued, for the slaves had not yet been worn down by long confinement, nor become resigned to their fate, and as the cellar doors were opened to receive them, very much like the mouth of a waiting grave, several of the younger men staged a revolt. They had evidently found some means of getting loose along their journey. Two of the guards went down at once, bludgeoned with the very chains that had bound the slaves, and the others began to stumble back and away, firing indiscriminately in their panic. A troop of guards came running down from their posts, adding to the general melee. It was a hopeless attempt, if gallant, and most of the loosed men saw the inevitable and dashed for their personal freedom. Some scrambled down the beach, others fled into the city. The guards managed to cow the remaining bound slaves again and started shooting at the escaping ones. Most were killed before they were out of sight, and search parties organized immediately to find the remainder, marked as they were by their nakedness and the galls from their former chains. The dirt road leading to the dungeons was muddy with blood, the small and huddled corpses lying terribly still among the living. Many women and children had been killed in the action. The slavers were already forcing the remaining men and women down into the cellar, and setting some of the others to drag the bodies away. Not 15 minutes had gone by.
There was no singing or shouting as the anchor was hauled up, and the operation went more slowly than usual, but even so the boatswain, ordinarily vigorous at any sign of malingering, did not start anyone with his cane. The day was again stickily humid, and so hot that the tar grew liquid and fell in great black splotches from the rigging, some even landing upon Temeraire's hide, much to his disgust. Lawrence set the runners and the ensigns on watch with buckets and rags, to clean him off as the drops fell, and by the end of the day they were all drooping and filthy themselves. The next day only more of the same, and the three after that. The shore tangled and impenetrable to larboard, broken only by cliffs and jumbled rockfalls, and a constant attention necessary to keep the ship at a safe distance in deep water, with the winds freakish and variable so close to land. The men went about their work silent and unsmiling in the heat of the day. The evil news of Austerlitz had spread among them.
Chapter 8 Blythe at last emerged from the sick berth, much reduced, mostly to sit and doze in a chair on the deck. Martin was especially solicitous for his comfort, and apt to speak sharply to anyone who so much as jostled the makeshift awning they had rigged over him. Blythe could scarcely cough, but a glass of grog was put in his hand. He could not speak slightingly of the weather, but he would be offered, as appropriate, a rug, an oilskin, a cool cloth.
"I'm sorry he's taken it so to heart, sir," Blythe told Lawrence helplessly. "I don't suppose any high-spirited fellow could have stood it kindly, the way them tars were going on, and no fault of his, I'm sure. I wish he wouldn't take on so."
The sailors were not pleased to see the offender so cosseted, and by way of answer made much of their fellow Reynolds, already inclined to put on a martyr's airs. In ordinary course he was only an indifferent seaman, and the new degree of respect he was receiving from his company went to his head. He strutted about the deck like Cock Robin, giving unnecessary orders for the pleasure of seeing them followed with such excess of bows and nods and forelock pulling. Even Purbeck and Riley did not much check him. Lawrence had hoped that at least the shared disaster of Austerlitz might mute the hostility between the sailors and the aviators, but this display kept tempers on both sides at an elevated pitch. The Allegiance was now drawing close to the equatorial line, and Lawrence thought it necessary to make special arrangements for managing the usual crossing ceremony. Less than half of the aviators had ever crossed the line before, and if the sailors were given license to dunk and shave the lot of them under the present mood, Lawrence did not think order could possibly be maintained. He consulted with Riley, and the agreement was reached that he would offer a general tithe on behalf of his men, namely 3 casks of rum which he had taken the precaution of acquiring in Cape Coast. The aviators would therefore be universally excused. All the sailors were disgruntled by the alteration in their tradition, several going so far as to speak of bad luck to the ship as a consequence. Undoubtedly many of them had privately been looking forward to the opportunity to humiliate their shipboard rivals. As a result, when at last they crossed the equator and the usual pageant came aboard, it was rather quiet and unenthusiastic. Temeraire at least was entertained, though Lawrence had to shush him hastily when he said, very audibly,
"But Lawrence, that is not Neptune at all. That is Griggs, and Amphitrite is Boyne,"
recognising the seamen through their shabby costumes, which they had not taken much trouble to make effective. This produced a good deal of imperfectly suppressed hilarity among the crew, and Badger Bag, the carpenter's mate Leddows, less recognisable under a scruffy mop head for a judicial wig, had a fit of inspiration and declared that this time all those who allowed laughter to escape should be Neptune's victims. Lawrence gave Riley a quick nod, and Leddows was given a free hand among both sailors and aviators. Fair numbers of each were seized, all the rest applauding, and to cap the occasion Riley sang out,
"An extra ration of grog for all, thanks to the toll paid by Captain Lawrence's crew,"
producing an enthusiastic cheer. Some of the hands got up a set of music and another of dancing. The rum worked its effect, and soon even the aviators were clapping along and humming the music to the shanties, though they did not know the words. It was perhaps not as wholeheartedly cheerful as some crossings, but much better than Lawrence had feared. The Chinese had come on deck for the event, though naturally not subjected to the ritual, and watched with much discussion amongst themselves. It was, of course, a rather vulgar kind of entertainment, and Lawrence felt some embarrassment at having Yong Xing witness it. but Liu Bao thumped his thigh in applause along with the entire crew, and let out a tremendous, booming laugh for each of Badger Bag's victims. He at length turned to Temeraire across the boundary and asked him a question.
"Lawrence, he would like to know what the purpose of the ceremony is, and which spirits are being honoured," Temeraire said. "But I do not know myself. What are we celebrating and why?"
"Oh," Lawrence said, wondering how to explain the rather ridiculous ceremony. "We have just crossed the equator, and it is an old tradition that those who have never crossed the line before must pay respects to Neptune, that is the Roman god of the sea, though of course he is not actually worshipped any more."
"Ah,"
Liu Bao said approvingly, when this had been translated for him.
"I like that. It is good to show respect to old gods, even if they are not yours. It must be very good luck for the ship, and it is only 19 days until the new year. We will have to have a feast on board, and that will be good luck, too. The spirits of our ancestors will guide the ship back to China."
Lawrence was dubious, but the sailors, listening in to the translation with much interest, found much to approve in this speech. Both the feast and the promised good luck, which appealed to their superstitious habit of thought. Although the mention of spirits was cause for a great deal of serious below-decks debate, being a little too close to ghosts for comfort, in the end it was generally agreed that as ancestor spirits these would have to be benevolently inclined towards the descendants being carried by the ship, and therefore not to be feared. "They have asked me for a cow and 4 sheep, and all 8 of the remaining chickens also. We will have to put in at St. Helena after all. We will make the turn westward tomorrow. At least it will be easier sailing than all this beating into the trades we've been doing," Riley said, watching dubiously a few days later. Several of the Chinese servants were busy fishing for sharks. "I only hope the liquor is not too strong. I must give it to the hands in addition to their grog ration, not in its place, or it would be no celebration at all."
"I am sorry to give you any cause for alarm, but Liu Bao alone can drink 2 of me under the table. I have seen him put away 3 bottles of wine in a sitting,"
Lawrence said ruefully, speaking from much painful experience. The envoy had dined with him convivially several more times since Christmas, and if he were suffering any lingering ill effects whatsoever from the seasickness, it could not be told from his appetite.
"For that matter, though Sun Kai does not drink a great deal, brandy and wine are all the same to him, as far as I can tell."
"Oh, to the devil with them," Riley said, sighing. "Well, perhaps a few dozen able seamen will get themselves into enough trouble that I can take away their grog for the night. What do you suppose they are going to do with those sharks? They have thrown back 2 porpoises already, and those are much better eating." Lawrence was ill-prepared to venture upon a guess, but he did not have to. At that moment the lookout called, "Wing 3 points off the larboard bow!" and they hurried at once to the side, to pull out their telescopes and peer into the sky, while sailors stampeded to their posts in case it should be an attack. Temeraire had lifted his head from his nap at the noise.
"Lawrence, it is Volley!" he called down from the dragon deck. "He has seen us! He is coming this way!"
Following this announcement, he roared out a greeting that made nearly every man jump and rattled the masts. Several of the sailors looked darkly towards him, though none ventured a complaint. Temeraire shifted himself about to make room, and some 15 minutes later the little grayling courier dropped down onto the deck, furling his broad, grey-and-white streaked wings.
"Temeraire,"
he said, and butted Temeraire happily with his head.
"Cow?"
"No, Volley, but we can fetch you a sheep," Temeraire said indulgently. "Has he been hurt?"
he asked James. The little dragon sounded queerly nasal. Volley's captain, Langford James, slid down.
"Hello, Lawrence, there you are. We've been looking for you up and down the coast," he said, reaching out to take Lawrence's hand. "No need to fret, Temeraire. He has only caught this blasted cold going about Dover. Half the dragons are moaning and sniffling about. They're the greatest children imaginable. But he will be right as rain in a week or two."
More, rather than less alarmed by these reassurances, Temeraire edged a little distance away from Volley. He did not look particularly eager to experience his first illness. Lawrence nodded. The letter he had had from Jane Rowland had mentioned the sickness in passing.
"I hope you have not strained him on our account, coming so far. Shall I send for my surgeon?" he offered.
"No, thank you. He has been doctored enough. "'It'll be another week before he forgets the medicine he swallowed "'and forgives me for slipping it into his dinner,' James said, waving away the request. "'Any road, we've not come so very far. "'We have been down here flying the southern route the last 2 weeks, "'and it is a damned sight warmer here than in jolly old England, you know. "'Volley's hardly shy about letting me know if he don't care to fly, either, "'so as long as he doesn't speak up, I'll keep him in the air.' "'He petted the little dragon, who bumped his nose against James's hand, "'and then lowered his head directly to sleep.
"'What news is there?'
Lawrence asked, "'shuffling through the post that James had handed over. "'His responsibility rather than Riley's, "'as it had been brought by Dragon Courier.
"'Has there been any change on the continent? "'We heard news of Austerlitz at Cape Coast. "'Are we recalled?' "'Ferris, see these to Lord Purbeck and the rest among our crew,' he added, "'handing the other letters off.
"'For himself he had a dispatch and a couple of letters, "'though he politely tucked them into his jacket "'rather than looking at them at once. "'No to both, more's the pity, "'but at least we can make the trip a little easier for you. "'We have taken the Dutch colony at Cape Town,' James said. "'Seized it last month, so you can break your journey there.' "'The news leapt from one end of the deck to the other "'with speed fuelled by the enthusiasm of men "'who had been long brooding over the grim news "'of Napoleon's latest success.' And the allegiance was instantly afire with patriotic cheers. No further conversation was possible until some measure of calm had been restored. The post did some work to this effect, Purbeck and Ferris handing it out among the respective crews, and gradually the noise collected into smaller pockets, many of the other men deep into their letters. Lawrence sent for a table and chairs to be brought up to the Dragon deck, inviting Riley and Hammond to join them and hear the news. James was happy to give them a more detailed account of the capture than was contained in the brief dispatch. He had been a courier from the age of 14, and had a turn for the dramatic, though in this case he had little material to work from. "'I'm sorry it doesn't make a better story. It was not really a fight, you know,' he said apologetically. "'We had the Highlanders there, and the Dutch only some mercenaries. They ran away before we even reached the town. The governor had to surrender. The people are still a little uneasy, but General Baird is leaving local affairs to them, and they have not kicked up much of a fuss. "'Well, it will certainly make resupply easier,' Riley said. "'We need not stop in St. Helena either, and that will be a savings of as much as 2 weeks. It is very welcome news indeed.'
"'Will you stay for dinner?' Lawrence asked James. "'Or must you be going straight away?'
Volley abruptly sneezed behind him, a loud and startling noise. "Ick!" the little dragon said, waking himself up out of his sleep, and rubbed his nose against his foreleg in distaste, trying to scrape the mucus from his snout.
"Oh, stop that, filthy wretch!" James said, getting up.
He took a large white linen square from his harness bags and wiped Volley clean with a weary air of long practice.
"I suppose we will stay the night," he said after, contemplating Volley. "No need to press him, now that I have found you in time, and you can write any letters you like me to take on. We are homeward bound after we leave you."
"So my poor Lily, like Exidium and Mortiferous, has been banished from her comfortable clearing to the sand-pits, for when she sneezes she cannot help but spit some of the acid, the muscles involved in this reflex, so the surgeons tell me, being the very same."
"They all three are very disgusted with their situation, as the sand cannot be got rid of from day to day, and they scratch themselves like dogs trying to cast off fleas, no matter how they bathe. Maximus is in deep disgrace, for he began sneezing first, and all the other dragons like to have someone to blame for their misery. However, he bears it well, or, as Berkeley tells me to write, does not give a tinker's damn for the lot of them and whines all the day, except when busy stuffing his gullet, has not hurt his appetite in the least. We all do very well otherwise, and all send their love, the dragons also, and bid you convey their greetings and affection to Temeraire. They indeed miss him badly, though I am sorry to have to tell you that we have lately discovered one ignoble cause for their pining, which is plain greed. Evidently he had taught them how to pry open the feeding-pen, and close it again after, so they were able to help themselves whenever they liked, without anyone the wiser. Their guilty secret discovered only after note was taken that the herds were oddly diminished, and the dragons of our formation overfed, whereupon being questioned they confessed the whole. I must stop, for we have patrol, and Volatilis goes south in the morning. All our prayers for your safe journey and quick return, etc., Catherine Harcourt."
"'What is this I hear from Harcourt of your teaching the dragons to steal from the pen?' Lawrence demanded, looking up from his letter.
He was taking the hour before dinner to read his mail and compose replies. Temeraire started up with so very revealing an expression that his guilt could be in no doubt.
"That is not true. I did not teach anyone to steal," he said. "The herdsmen at Dover are very lazy, and do not always come in the morning, so we have to wait and wait at the pen, and the herds are meant for us anyway. It cannot be called stealing."
"I suppose I ought to have suspected something when you stopped complaining of them being always late," Lawrence said. "But how on earth did you manage it?"
"The gate is perfectly simple," Temeraire said. "There is only a bar across the fence, which one can lift very easily, and then it swings open. Nitidus could do it best, for his four hands are the smallest, though it is difficult to keep the animals inside the pen, and the first time I learned how to open it, they all ran away," he added. "Maximus and I had to chase after them for hours and hours. It was not funny, at all," he said, ruffled, sitting back on his haunches and contemplating Lawrence with great indignation.
"I beg your pardon," Lawrence said after he had regained his breath. "I truly beg your pardon. It was only the notion of you and Maximus and the sheep. Oh, dear," Lawrence said, and dissolved again, try as he might to contain himself. Astonished stares from his crew, and Temeraire haughtily offended.
"Is there any other news in the letter?" Temeraire asked coolly, when Lawrence had finally done.
"Not news, but all the dragons have sent you greetings and their love," Lawrence said, now conciliatory. "You may console yourself that they are all sick, and if you were there, you certainly would be also," he added, seeing Temeraire inclined to droop when reminded of his friends.
"I would not care if I were sick if I were home. Anyway, I am sure to catch it from Volley," Temeraire said gloomily, glancing over.
The little grayling was snuffling thickly in his sleep, bubbles of mucus swelling and shrinking over his nostrils as he breathed, and a small puddle of saliva had collected beneath his half-open mouth. Lawrence could not in honesty hold out much hope to the contrary, so he shifted the subject. "Have you any messages? I will go below now and write my replies, so James can carry them back. The last chance of sending a word by courier we will have for a long time, I am afraid, for ours do not go to the Far East except for some truly urgent matter."
"Only to send my love," Temeraire said, "and to tell Captain Harcourt and also Admiral Lenton it was not stealing in the least. Oh, and also tell Maximus and Lily about the poem written by the dragon, for that was very interesting, and perhaps they will like to hear of it, and also about my learning to climb aboard the ship, and that we have crossed the equator, and about Neptune and Badger Bag."
"Enough, enough. You will have me writing a novel," Lawrence said, rising easily. Thankfully, his leg had at last put itself right, and he was no longer forced to limp about the deck like an old man. He stroked Temeraire's side. "Shall we come and sit with you while we have our port?" Temeraire snorted and nudged him affectionately with his nose.
"Thank you, Lawrence. That would be pleasant. And I would like to hear any news James has of the others, besides what is in your letters."
The replies finished at the stroke of three, Lawrence and his guests dined in unusual comfort. Ordinarily, Lawrence kept to his habit of formal decorum, and Granby and his own officers followed his lead, while Riley and his subordinates did so of their own accord and naval custom. They one and all sweltered through every meal under thick broadcloth and their snugly tied neckcloths. But James had a born aviator's disregard for propriety, coupled with the assurance of a man who had been a captain, even if only of a single-man courier, since the age of 14. With hardly a pause he discarded his outer garments on coming below, saying, "Good God, it is close in here! You must stifle, Lawrence!" Lawrence was not sorry to follow his example, which he would have done regardless out of a desire not to make him feel out of place. Granby immediately followed suit, and after a brief surprise, Riley and Hammond matched them, though Lord Purbeck kept his coat and his expression fixed, clearly disapproving. The dinner went cheerfully enough, though at Lawrence's request James reserved his own news until they were comfortably ensconced on the dragon deck with their cigars and port, where Temeraire could hear, and with his body provide a bulwark against the rest of the crew's eavesdropping. Lawrence dismissed the aviators down to the forecastle, this leaving only Sun Kai, as usual taking the air in the reserved corner of the dragon deck, close enough to overhear what should be quite meaningless to him. James had much to tell them of formation movements.
Nearly all the dragons of the Mediterranean division had been reassigned to the Channel, Litificat and Excursius and their respective formations, to provide a thoroughly impenetrable opposition, should Bonaparte once again attempt invasion through the air, emboldened by his success on the continent. "Not much left to stop them from trying for Gibraltar, though, with all this shifting about," Riley said. "And we must keep watch over Toulon. We may have taken 20 prizes at Trafalgar, but now Bonaparte has every forest in Europe at his disposal. He can build more ships. I hope the Ministry have a care for it." "Oh, hell," James said, sitting up with a thump. His chair had been tilted rather precariously backwards as he reclined with his feet on the rail. "I am being a dunce. I suppose you haven't heard about Mr. Pitt."
"He is not still ill," Hammond said anxiously.
"Not ill in the least," James said. "Dead, this last fortnight and more. The news killed him, they say. He took his bed after we heard of the armistice and never got out of it again."
"God rest his soul," Riley said.
"Amen," Lawrence said, deeply shocked.
Pitt had not been an old man, younger than his father, certainly.
"Who is Mr. Pitt?" Temeraire inquired,
and Lawrence paused to explain to him the post of Prime Minister.
"James, have you any word on who will form the new government?" he asked,
already wondering what this might mean for himself and Temeraire if the new minister felt China ought to be dealt with differently, in either more conciliatory or more belligerent manner. "No, I was off before more than the bare word had reached us," James said. "I promise if anything has changed when I get back, I will do my best and bring you the news at Cape Town. But," he added, "they send us down here less than once in a 6 month, ordinarily, so I shouldn't hope for it. The landing sites are too uncertain, and we have lost couriers without a trace here before trying to go overland, or even just spend a night on shore." James set off again the next morning, waving at them from Volley's back until the little grey-white dragon disappeared entirely into the thready, low-hanging clouds. Lawrence had managed to pen a brief reply to Harcourt, as well as appending to his already-begun letters for his mother and Jane, and the courier had carried them all away. The last word they would receive from him for months, almost certainly. There was little time for melancholy. He was at once called below to consult with Liu Bao on the appropriate substitute for some sort of monkey organ which was ordinarily used in a dish. Having suggested lamb kidneys, Lawrence was instantly solicited for assistance with another task, and the rest of the week passed in increasingly frantic preparations, the galley going day and night at full steam, until the dragon deck grew so warm that even Temeraire began to feel it a little excessive. The Chinese servants also set to clearing the ship of vermin, a hopeless task, but one in which they persevered. They came up to the deck sometimes 5 or 6 times in a day to fling the bodies of rats overboard into the sea, while the midshipmen looked on in outrage, these ordinarily serving, late in a voyage, as part of their own meals. Lawrence had not the least idea what to expect from the occasion, but was careful to dress with a special formality, borrowing Riley's steward Jethson to valet him. His best shirt starched and ironed, silk stockings and knee breeches instead of trousers, with his polished Hessian boots, his dress coat, bottle green, with gold bars on the shoulders, and his decorations. The gold medal of the Nile, where he had been a naval lieutenant, on its broad blue ribbon, and the silver pin voted recently to the captains of the Dover battle. He was very glad to have taken so many pains when he entered the Chinese quarters. Passing through the door, he had to duck beneath a sweep of heavy red cloth, and found the room so richly draped with hangings it might have been taken for a grand pavilion on land, except for the steady motion of the ship beneath their feet. The table was laid with delicate porcelain, each piece of different colour, many edged with gold and silver, and the lacquered eating sticks which Lawrence had been dreading all week were at every place. Yong Xing was already seated at the head of the table, in imposing state and wearing his most formal robes, in the deep golden silk embroidered with dragons in blue and black thread. Lawrence was seated close enough to see that there were small chips of gemstones for the dragon's eyes and talons, and in the very centre of the front, covering the chest, was a single dragon figure larger than the rest, embroidered in pure white silk, with chips of rubies for its eyes and 5 outstretched talons on each foot. Somehow they were all crammed in, down to little Roland and Dyer, the younger officers fairly squashed together at their separate table, and their faces already shining and pink in the heat. The servants began pouring the wine directly everyone was seated, others coming in from the galley to lay down great platters along the length of the tables. Cold sliced meats, interspersed with an assortment of dark yellow nuts, preserved cherries, and prawns with their heads and dangling forelegs intact. Yongxing took up his cup for the first toast, and all hurried to drink with him. The rice wine was served warm and went down with dangerous ease. This was evidently the signal for a general beginning. The Chinese started in on the platters, and the younger men at least had little hesitation in following suit. Lawrence was embarrassed to see, when he glanced over, that Roland and Dyer were having not the least difficulty with their chopsticks, and were already round-cheeked from stuffing food into their mouths. He himself had only just managed to get a piece of the beef to his mouth by dint of puncturing it with one of his sticks. The meat had a smoky, not unpleasant quality. No sooner had he swallowed than Yongxing raised the cup for another toast, and he had to drink again. This succession repeated itself several times more, until he was uncomfortably warm, his head nearly swimming. Growing slowly braver with the sticks, he risked a prawn, though the other officers about him were avoiding them. The sauce made them slippery and awkward to manage. It wobbled precariously, the beady black eyes bobbing at him. He followed the Chinese example and bit it off just behind the attached head. At once he groped for the cup again, breathing deeply through his nose. The sauce was shockingly hot, and broke a fresh sweat out upon his forehead, the drops trickling down the side of his jaw into his collar. Liu Bao laughed uproariously at his expression and poured him more wine, leaning across the table and thumping him approvingly on the shoulder. The platters were shortly taken off the tables and replaced with an array of wooden dishes full of dumplings, some with thin crepe paper skins and others of thick, yeasty white dough. These were at least easier to get hold of with the sticks and could be chewed and swallowed whole. The cooks had evidently exercised some ingenuity, lacking essential ingredients. Lawrence found a piece of seaweed in one, and the lamb kidneys made their appearance also. Three further courses of small dishes ensued, then a strange dish of uncooked fish, pale, pink, and fleshy, with cold noodles and pickled greens gone dull brown with long storage. A strange crunchy substance in the mixture was identified after inquiry by Hammond as dried jellyfish, which intelligence caused several men to surreptitiously pick the bits out and drop them onto the floor. Liu Bao, with motions and his own example, encouraged Lawrence to literally fling the ingredients into the air to mix them together, and Hammond informed them by translation that this was intended to ensure good luck. The higher the better. The British were not unwilling to make the attempt. Their coordination was less equal to the task, however, and shortly both uniforms and the table were graced by bits of fish and pickled greens. Dignity was thus dealt a fatal blow. After nearly a jug of rice wine to every man, even Yongxing's presence was not enough to dampen the hilarity ensuing from watching their fellow officers fling bits of fish all over themselves. "It is a dashed sight better than we had in the Normandy's cutter," Riley said to Lawrence, overloud, meaning the raw fish. To the more general audience, interest having been expressed by Hammond and Liu Bao both, he expanded on the story. "We were wrecked in the Normandy when Captain Yarrow ran her onto a reef, all of us thrown on a desert island 700 miles from Rio. We were sent off in the cutter for rescue. Though Lawrence was only second lieutenant at the time, the captain and premier knew less about the sea than trained apes, which is how they came to run us aground. They wouldn't go themselves, for love or money, or give us much in the way of supply either," he added, still smarting at the memory.
12 men with nothing but hard tack and a bag of coconuts. We were glad enough for fish to eat it raw with our fingers the moment we caught it," Lawrence said. "But I cannot complain. I am tolerably sure Foley tapped me for his first lieutenant in the Goliath because of it, and I would have eaten a good deal more raw fish for the chance. But this is much nicer by far," he added hastily, thinking this conversation implied that raw fish was fit only for consumption in desperate circumstances, which opinion he privately held true, but not to be shared at present. This story launched several more anecdotes from various of the naval officers, tongues loosened and backs unstiffened by so much gluttony. The translator was kept busy rendering these for the benefit of the highly interested Chinese audience. Even Yongxing followed the stories. He had still not deigned to break his silence, save for the formal toasts,
but there was something of a mellowing about his eyes. Liu Ba was less circumspect about his curiosity.
"You have been to a great many places, I see, and had unusual adventures," he observed to Lawrence. "Admiral Zheng sailed all the way to Africa, but he died on his 7th voyage, and his tomb is empty. You have gone around the world more than once. Have you never been worried that you would die at sea, and no one would perform the rites at your grave?"
"I have never thought very much about it," Lawrence said, with a little dishonesty. In truth, he had never given the matter any consideration whatsoever. "But after all, Drake and Cook and so many other great men have been buried at sea. I really could not complain about sharing their tomb, sir, and with your own navigator as well."
"Well, I hope you have many sons at home," Liu Bao said, shaking his head.
The casual air with which he made so personal a remark took Lawrence quite aback.
"No, sir, none," he said,
too startled to think of anything to do but answer.
"I have never married," he added,
seeing Liu Bao about to assume an expression of great sympathy, which on this answer being translated became a look of open astonishment. Yong Xing and even Sun Kai turned their heads to stare. Beleaguered, Lawrence tried to explain.
"There is no urgency. I am a third son, and my eldest brother has 3 boys already himself."
"Pardon me, Captain, if I may," Hammond broke in, rescuing him, and said to them, "Gentlemen, among us, the eldest son alone inherits the family estates, and the younger are expected to make their own way. I know it is not the same with you."
"I suppose your father is a soldier, like you," Yong Xing said abruptly. "Does he have a very small estate that he cannot provide for all his sons?"
"No, sir. My father is Lord Allendale," Lawrence said, rather nettled by the suggestion. "Our family seat is in Nottinghamshire. I do not think anyone would call it small."
Yong Xing looked startled and somewhat displeased by this answer, but perhaps he was only frowning at the soup, which was at that moment being laid out before them. A very clear broth, pale gold and queer to the taste, smoky and thin, with pitchers of bright red vinegar as accompaniment and to add sharp flavour, and masses of short dried noodles in each bowl, strangely crunchy. All the while the servants were bringing it in, the translator had been murmuring quietly in answer to some question from Sun Kai, and now on his behalf leaned across the table and asked,
"Captain, is your father a relation of the king?"
Though surprised by the question, Lawrence was grateful enough for any excuse to put down his spoon. He would have found the soup difficult eating, even had he not already gone through 6 courses.
"No, sir. I would hardly be so bold as to call His Majesty a relation. My father's family are of Plantagenet descent. We are only very distantly connected to the present house."
Sun Kai listened to this translated, then persisted a little further.
"But are you more closely related to the king than the Lord Macartney?"
As the translator pronounced the name a little awkwardly, Lawrence had some difficulty in recognizing the name as that of the earlier ambassador, until Hammond, whispering hastily in his ear, made it clear to whom Sun Kai was referring.
"Oh, certainly," Lawrence said. "He was raised to the peerage for service to the crown himself. Not that that is held any less honourable with us, I assure you, but my father is 11th Earl of Allendale, and his creation dates from 1529.
Even as he spoke, he was amused at finding himself so absurdly jealous of his ancestry, halfway around the world, in the company of men to whom it could be of no consequence whatsoever, when he had never trumpeted it among his acquaintance at home. Indeed, he had often rebelled against his father's lectures upon the subject, of which there had been many, particularly after his first abortive attempt to run away to sea. But 4 weeks of being daily called into his father's office to endure another repetition had evidently had some effect he had not previously suspected, if he could be provoked to so stuffy a response by being compared with a great diplomat of very respectable lineage. But quite contrary to his expectations, Sun Kai and his countrymen showed a deep fascination with this intelligence, betraying an enthusiasm for genealogy Lawrence had heretofore only encountered in a few of his more stiff-necked relations. And he shortly found himself pressed for details of the family history, which he could only vaguely dredge out of his memory.
"I beg your pardon," he said at last, growing rather desperate. "I cannot keep it straight in my head without writing it down. You must forgive me."
It was an unfortunate choice of gambit, Liu Bao, who had also been listening with interest, promptly said,
"Oh, that is easy enough,"
and called for brush and ink. The servants were clearing away the soup, and there was room on the table for the moment. At once all those nearby leaned forward to look on, the Chinese in curiosity, the British in self-defence. There was another course waiting in the wings, and no one but the cooks was in a hurry for it to arrive. Feeling that he was being excessively punished for his moment of vanity, Lawrence was forced to write out a chart on a long roll of rice paper under all their eyes. The difficulty of forming the Latin alphabet with a paintbrush was added to that of trying to remember the various bigats. He had to leave several given names blank, marking them with interrogatives, before finally reaching Edward III after several contortions and one leap through the Salic line. The result said nothing complimentary about his penmanship, but the Chinese passed it around more than once, discussing it amongst themselves with energy, though the writing could hardly have made any more sense to them than theirs to him. Yong Xing himself stared at it a long time, though his face remained devoid of emotion, and Sun Kai, receiving it last, rolled it away with an expression of intense satisfaction, apparently for safekeeping.